Please be seated, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning. First matter this morning is the swearing in.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here to move the admission of Judge Kaney's law clerk, Marie Miller, who received her undergraduate degree from Notre Dame, and her law school degree is from the Indiana University Auer School of Law in Bloomington. And she's admitted to practice in the state of Indiana.
Being no objection, particularly from Notre Dame. And,
no, I'm all in favor.
you're admitted and should take the oath.
Thank you.
The first case this morning is First Midwest Bank versus City of Chicago. Ms. Casper?
May it please the court. The judgment rests on an invalid legal theory and cannot stand. This morning I will explain that the city owed no duty under the Constitution to Mr. Laporta to prevent his injuries at the hands of Kelly. Therefore, there was no constitutional violation, and absent a constitutional violation, there's no liability under Monell. The city is therefore entitled to judgment as a matter of law. DeShaney holds, subject to two exceptions that are not at issue in this case, that the government has no duty under the Due Process Clause to take steps to prevent private violence. Here, plaintiff held the city liable for just that. Plaintiff's claim was that the city violated due process by failing to discipline police officers, including Kelly, and failing to have an early warning system, and that those failures caused Mr. Laporta's injuries. Because Kelly was undisputedly a private actor, indeed plaintiffs concede this expressly, at the time he shot Mr. Laporta. That is a claim that the city failed to prevent private violence, and it is squarely barred under DeShaney.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. Why isn't their theory that this is state-created danger? As I understand their theory, it is that the city of Chicago's policies with respect to the police force created a monster, created someone who thought he could act with impunity, and it was therefore highly foreseeable that at some point it was going to result in this. It's kind of a Gibson theory, albeit in slightly different facts. And I'm not saying it should succeed as such, but I guess I'd like you to talk about why this isn't squarely within that line of authority.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by pointing out that even plaintiff does not consider this to be a state-created danger case. On that issue, plaintiffs expressly state in their brief that the state-created danger exception is the wrong doctrinal framework for cases like Gibson and this one. And they also state that some of the cases analyze claims under the state-created danger theory, but that theory is irrelevant here. Having said that, the state-created danger theory would not apply here. It certainly was never litigated. We never adduced evidence that would have gone to that. We never had the opportunity to develop facts on it. Beyond that, the plaintiff would have to show that acts by the city affirmatively increased the danger to a particular individual, here Mr. Laporta, and certainly there wasn't evidence of that, and that's probably why the theory was not pursued. In addition, there would have to be conscious shocking behavior, which was not adduced here either. And I would take a moment to note that the jury instruction did not instruct the jury on such issues either. And it's too late once a jury hears a case to come back on appeal and try to change a theory. And it can't be affirmed on a ground that the jury didn't even consider. And certainly, you know, there would be no evidence of shocks the conscience either. Failing, for example, failing to have an early warning system in place is not the kind of almost criminally reckless behavior that would shock the conscience.
So I understand you would like us to overrule Gibson, but do we have to?
To rule in your favor? We don't have to.
It certainly makes it harder for you to win.
Well, we have offered, Your Honor, a theory that would attempt to reconcile Gibson with the law of every single other circuit in the country that has considered the issue, and that would be, you know, even in police cases in particular, we have the 2nd, the 3rd, the 4th, the 6th, the 8th, and the 9th, and this court in Latuskin and Wilson-Trattner. So certainly Gibson would be, is causing problems in the district court, with district courts believing they need to follow Gibson, even in light of Latuskin and Wilson-Trattner. Do you have to overrule it? No, we have a theory that we offer that it is a state-created danger type case. At least that's what the court thought. Of course, we do explain in our brief that even as a state-created danger case, it's not in line with cases that have developed that doctrine since DeShaney. So, you know, in the end, it would be important, we think, to at a minimum clarify what is meant in Gibson if it's not what plaintiffs and the district court think it means, but certainly in the interest of avoiding further confusion going forward, we do ask that it be overruled.
The Gibson opinion doesn't really represent itself to be a state-created danger case. That language referring to DeShaney is in a footnote, and by way of explanation that the theory that the court was permitting to proceed past summary judgment was not foreclosed by DeShaney, which appears to be a misreading of DeShaney and the state-created danger, because there was no evidence in that case, although there's a conflict in the opinion itself and whether it was decided on summary judgment evidence insufficiency grounds or 12b6, because there's some backup language in Gibson referring to that particular issue really being governed by 12b6 and what was pleaded in the complaint and the allegations in the complaint being sufficient to move forward. So it's a little bit of a schizophrenic decision procedurally as well as substantively, and that perhaps accounts for the confusion in the district courts, which is widespread.
It is widespread, Your Honor, and I agree with your assessment of Gibson. Plaintiffs and district courts are relying on it for a proposition that really is not the law, even as stated in other cases by this circuit. And, you know, as we cite in our brief, there are multiple instances in the district court where cases are being allowed to go forward. This one has obviously gone all the way to trial to a verdict. They read Gibson to argue that the city supplies the state action and that's enough to make it liable pursuant to Monell for every injury that its policies cause. But
that, you know, omits any substantive analysis of the constitutional right in question.
That's true, Your
which
Honor.
Gibson did not say one word about.
That's correct, Your Honor. And what's being alleged here, although it may be consistent with some language in Gibson, the problem is that even in Gibson or here, as Your Honor points out, the steps that the city is being alleged to have failed to take are exactly what DeShaney says the government has no duty under the Constitution to do. And so to the extent Gibson is to the contrary, it should be overruled. Plaintiff tries to bolster Gibson by arguing it's an application of Canton, which plaintiff says allows municipalities to be held liable when their deliberately indifferent policies cause injury. But again, that leaves out the constitutional duty and the constitutional violation. And the court made this clear in Collins, where it rejected exactly that reading.
Monell is just an interpretation of Section 1983. There
exactly
must
right.
always be a constitutional violation.
That's exactly
a substantive
right.
constitutional violation.
Right.
And Gibson omitted that step.
That's correct.
Could Monell and DeShaney operate in tandem. There was a municipal defendant in DeShaney.
Absolutely.
As there is in legions of our cases applying the state-created danger exception.
That's true, Your Honor. And again, here, we don't even have an attempt to state a duty under state-created danger or custody, the only two exceptions that DeShaney even arguably, you know, allowed for. So here, we simply have a case where the city has been held liable when it has no duty under the Constitution at all.
And the state go ahead.
Go ahead.
The state-created danger exception is indeed extremely narrow.
It is.
And is reserved for egregious conduct by municipalities and public officials, and is subject to a very high standard.
It is, Your Honor. And we, as I responded earlier, we would not see any possibility it could be satisfied in this case for that reason. And beyond that, it was just never litigated as a case under that exception, probably just for that reason.
Could you ever have a case in which a municipality could be liable for police conduct that was not committed under color of law? For example, what if here the city of Chicago, and if we looked at the Chicago Police Department policies, what if they explicitly told police officers, you know, you can do what you want with impunity, you've got the authority, you've got the gun, we've got your back, go forth. And in ways that were far more explicit than the ones alleged here, emboldened police officers to use excessive force in their private lives. Is it conceivable? Is there any situation in which a municipality could have liability?
I mean, I think it would depend on the facts. It's conceivable that there could, that I think that would get into a state action analysis. It could come to the point where, you know, there was some real direction to do something or the city compelling to take a particular action. We obviously don't have that here. But if there were a situation like that, then I think state action might be something that would have to be talked about or litigated. Again, it was not litigated at all here.
No, I understand that. But I'm wondering if the court, if I mean, you've asked us to say that if the individual who has acted is not acting under color of law, that the municipality can never be liable. So I'm asking you whether the rule is really that absolute or whether there could be any circumstances in which the municipality could be liable for private conduct.
Well, we, like I said, I don't think it would be private conduct anymore at that point.
So your answer is that it would always be analyzed under state action, and did this rise to the level of state action?
I believe that's correct. I mean, there are cases in this circuit that have allowed a municipality to be liable without an underlying actor being liable at all, but that wasn't on, because he wasn't a state actor, and that those cases are very different, as we explained in our brief, because in those cases there was a constitutional duty that was alleged to have been breached. So
those are largely the medical injury cases?
They are, Your Honor, the Eighth Amendment cases, Glisson and Thomas, that plaintiffs cite. So that's a situation. So we don't want to be understood to say the municipality can't be liable unless an underlying actor is liable. But what Your Honor is referring to would be a state action analysis. And the answer is no, the city wouldn't be liable if the action is purely private. Unless there are any questions, we'd like to rest on our brief for our alternative argument that if the court is going, would affirm on liability, that they consider a new trial on damages only based on counsel's closing argument asking the jury to send a message and reading of a letter that he wrote himself in Mr. LaPorta's voice being improper and prejudicial. And we will rest on our brief for that, and I'll save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Shapiro.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Carolyn Shapiro, and I represent the plaintiff in this case. And Judge Sykes, I'd like to start with exactly what you were talking about, which is, what is the constitutional violation here? And the constitutional violation here is a violation of the 14th Amendment due process right to bodily integrity. The city, the reason that it's a constitutional right is the city has a duty here not to deliberately maintain policies and practices that it knows empower police officers to become lawlessly violent. That is That, again, that duty arises from the 14th Amendment, and that is the duty that we proved to the jury was breached. Judge Barrett, the duty, the widespread policy and practice that we demonstrated exists to the jury is precisely the express policy you are describing. There is legally no distinction between what we proved to the jury, which is that the city promises police officers that they can act with impunity, and an express policy that says so. So I want to be clear, this case is not about private violence. It's not a case about a failure to protect. It's about the harms inflicted by the city itself. And I really want to emphasize, the city is not contesting the jury's findings here.
The harm was inflicted by the off-duty officer.
Well, there were...
The effort is to hold the city liable for the officer's conduct. The city did not violate anybody's bodily integrity. The off-duty officer did.
Well,
so this is an effort to use Monell in a way that is inconsistent with DeShaney, because it's really a failure to protect claim, and it can be described in many different ways, but it's a failure to protect claim.
So I would disagree on several grounds. First of all, it is always the case when the city is held liable for a police shooting on duty or off, that the city itself didn't physically hold the gun. It is always the case that the harm is inflicted by a police officer.
Correct, but the city owes a constitutional duty when the officer is on duty.
Well,
the
yes.
city does not owe a constitutional duty when the officer is off duty.
Well, actually, I think that's not correct, and let me explain why. There are things about the police that are unique, that require the city to monitor monitor them off duty, in ways that are, I think, quite different from really any other employee, and that go directly to the city's obligations to what they do on duty. So, for example, there was evidence in this case from both the Department of Justice report and the Police Accountability Task Force about feedback loop in the between off-duty violence and on-duty violence, particularly domestic violence, which Patrick Kelly was engaged in. Failure to detect and discipline and respond to off-duty domestic violence has the actual effect of making police officers more dangerous when they're on duty. And that violence, the DOJ found and explained, is likely to escalate over time. And if unchecked, that lack of discipline tells officers that they can act with impunity. In addition, a second reason why the police are different and the city has a different set of obligations related to them is that they have the exclusive right to exercise police powers, which they have 24 hours a day. Now, that does not mean that everything the police do is under color of law, and that is not our argument. But the point is that the city does have a duty to pay attention to what they're doing 24 hours a day, because at any time they could be acting under color of law. And in fact, the city has never argued that it doesn't have that obligation and that there aren't those kinds of implications from off-duty conduct.
That's an argument for a law enforcement exception to DeShaney, that because law enforcement officers have police power and carry guns and are authorized to use them 24/7. That's a categorical exception to the DeShaney failure to protect prohibition on liability.
You could consider it that way, but we think that this is about the city's affirmative acts. And what Monell tells us is that the city is liable for its own affirmative acts.
But counsel, don't you have a causation problem even under that theory? Even if you're thinking about, you know, Canton, for example, linking this, showing that it was so obvious, that it was highly predictable, that the kind of policies that you've alleged the city of Chicago and the Chicago Police Department to have caused this private actor off duty to shoot a gun, even Patrick Kelly, you know, domestic abuse and beating up his ex-girlfriend's brother, those things are far different from shooting someone in the back of the head with a gun.
So, first of all, causation is not at issue here. That was proved to the jury, and the jury found it. But I don't disagree that causation is a high bar. And that is one of the reasons why this the city's suggestion in its briefs that perhaps that not overruling Gibson leads to some kind of opening of the floodgates is just wrong. But let me tell you a little bit about the evidence that did exist in this case that goes to causation. We showed through the DOJ, through the PATF, through our expert, the remarkably low rate of complaints that lead to discipline. Out of 30,000 complaints, 2% of those lead to any discipline at all. And Kelly was among the 98% who did not receive discipline. By the time he shot,
who collected these? Where did this information come from?
The Department of Justice. Its report that it.
The recent.
Yes, okay. and the Police Accountability Task Force.
Well, that was report. A political approach to things.
Both of those reports were admitted as in evidence. Part excerpts from them were admitted in evidence in this trial. The jury heard them. The jury also heard testimony from our police practices expert that was completely consistent with those reports, and that is what the jury concluded. So there are factual findings here that the city engaged in this policy and practice of not disciplining its police officers.
But counsel, I think the reason why causation matters, it's another way of highlighting the problem that Judge Sykes is underscoring. You can try to plead around DeShaney by rather than saying that something is a failure to protect, it was affirmatively caused by your failure. And if you can't prove that link, if the link isn't close, then we're not really talking about the city having caused it. We're talking really about a creative way of evading DeShaney, right?
Well, I don't think so. And again, let me talk a little bit more about the record. And actually, I can talk a little bit about the record about what happened with the shooting itself, because I think that demonstrates how Patrick Kelly believed that he could act with impunity, how he thought that whatever he did, the police department would have his back. More or less the express policy that you described, which is in fact what we proved to the jury. So for example, on the night of the shooting, Patrick Kelly made sure when he called 911 that he said he was a police officer, he told the first officers who arrived that he was a police officer, and he told all of them that LaPorta had shot himself. Now, there were two people in the house when LaPorta was shot with Kelly's service weapon, but the detectives who came to investigate and IPRA, the Police Accountability Agency, both entirely failed to investigate the possibility that Kelly pulled the trigger. They failed to gather basic physical evidence. They failed to ask the most basic follow-up questions about inconsistencies in Kelly's several different statements that he made and aspects of those statements that were inconsistent with aspects of the physical evidence that did exist. And they never even asked Michael's family if there was some reason he might have wanted to hurt himself. They told them on the night of the shooting that Michael had tried to had attempted suicide. And in fact, at trial, Kelly took the Fifth Amendment when asked about the shooting, and the city continued to maintain that Michael tried to kill himself, and it continues to employ Kelly as a police officer. So despite everything that has happened, the 19 pre-shooting complaints, the shooting itself, the city has never investigated, and the city as Kelly has suffered absolutely no disciplinary consequences from the shooting itself. So a police officer under those circumstances, establishing causation, that the police officer believes that he can engage in whatever he wants, whatever lawless violence he wants, is a completely appropriate jury question, and here the jury concluded exactly that. It's a heavy lift for any plaintiff. It is not an easy thing to prove. We had these reports. We had two different experts who came in and testified. This was not inexpensive. This is not a simple matter of saying, well, they didn't bother to do this, and therefore I was harmed. It's a matter of showing that over, in this case, literally decades, the city has allowed its police officers to know that whatever they do, they will not be held accountable. I'd like to say a little bit more about DeShaney also. So, and why this is not a why this is not a case about private violence. DeShaney says quite clearly that, right, that the point of the Due Process Clause is not to protect people from each other. But in this case, what we have here is essentially state-empowered violence. That's different from the state-created danger exception, Judge Barrett, because the state create, of course, the way people use words, it's a state-created danger, but the state-created danger doctrine applies to, is an exception to DeShaney, and our position is that DeShaney doesn't apply. I will add, however, that below, in our briefing on summary judgment, we did argue an alternative theory of state-created danger. That's in our that's in document 286 at pages 4 through 8. We argued that, and the district court never ruled on it. So if you really think this is a state-created danger case, we did preserve that issue below.
But the case wasn't tried on state-created danger theory. The jury wasn't instructed on the elements of that.
It was not. I think the evidence, frankly, would probably be very similar. But it's not a state-created danger case because it's not a DeShaney case. And it's not a DeShaney case because Monell teaches us that the city can be liable for its own affirmative
action. Monell is not a substantive decision.
It's absolutely true.
It's a decision about what it takes to hold a municipality liable. It says nothing about the substance of the constitutional right. DeShaney tells us something about the substance of the constitutional right and must always be satisfied before we even get to Monell liability.
I completely
agree.
That's
why there's a footnote in DeShaney saying we don't have to talk about Monell liability here because there's no substantive claim.
Well,
so here, if there's no substantive claim, Monell is beside the point.
So let me, I agree that we have no disagreement about that
and
position.
And that's the whole problem with Gibson. It took things out of order.
Gibson was...
you don't get to Monell unless there's a substantive constitutional theory.
So our
operative in the case, yes, and evidence to support it.
So our substantive constitutional theory is that the city's affirmative acts over a period
of
years...
No, that's Monell. What's
no,
the substantive constitutional theory
is that the city's acts...
That's Monell. What is the...
That the city led...
Okay,
the city empowered its police officers through a deliberately maintained set of policies
and practices... That's describing the substantive constitutional theory in terms of municipal liability.
The city can only be liable...
What is the substantive constitutional right?
The substantive constitutional right is the right to bodily integrity. And that right, the court has recognized that that right can be violated by a municipality through its policies and practices.
Through its officers.
And
if the city fails to properly supervise train its officers.
Not exclusively. In King, for example, this court discussed the possibility that a policy or practice that goes to whether or not a child is released from a school in a particular situation could give rise to constitutional liability. Monell tells us, and what Section 1983 tells us, is that the city is liable if it had an express policy, like Judge Barrett described, that would be the source of the liability. That's exactly what we have here. It's just not express. But we proved that it is a widespread policy or custom that operates exactly the same way.
So you're saying that the city's policy itself was not facially constitutional as we might have in some failure to supervise cases. You're saying that the city's implicit, though functionally expressed, policy of do what you want, we've got your back, itself violated the 14th Amendment right to bodily integrity because of the, you know, highly predictable consequences that would flow from that.
Well, the Monell doesn't allow Monell says that when it's a widespread policy and custom, which is what we proved, mm-hmm, we still have to go, that is a Monell-type claim, not a facially unconstitutional type claim. But yes, that is exactly the point. The point is that the policy itself is the policy that says, we're going to give you a gun, we're going to give you a badge, and we're going to give you impunity. And the highly predictable consequences of that is that police officers are going to act with impunity. That is what the Department of Justice report describes.
And if they do that on duty, that's a constitutional violation. If they do that off duty, it's not a constitutional violation.
If they do it on duty but not under color of law, it's not a constitutional violation. So the city's position is that it has no constitutional obligation to monitor what its officers do, even on duty, as long as they're not acting under color of law. And police officers often leave their posts to run an errand, to go home, perhaps to go home to beat up their girlfriend. The city's position is it has no obligation constitutionally even to monitor and discipline that behavior because it's not under color of law. Okay.
Well, that's a separate question. We've got clear off-duty private conduct here that is that caused the injury, and that was the violation of bodily integrity, but it's not a constitutional violation. It's just a common law tort because it was private actor violence. And that brings us into DeShaney squarely.
DeShaney says, if the city, let's say the city had a policy, a facially unconstitutional policy, that said that police officers have the right to shoot anybody they want or are authorized to shoot anybody they want on duty or off. And police officers, when they're off duty, act on that. That's our case.
But the city says that's a state action question. Do you
disagree with that? In some sense, this is a state action question, but we've proven the state action. The state
action.
So you're
saying that
policy.
It was state action when he shot?
I'm saying it's state, the city's policies and practices maintained over years with full knowledge that they are empowering police officers to act with impunity on duty and off is a state action.
Your proof of that policy is through the Department of Justice report, right?
Not exclusively, but yes, the Department of Justice report.
Well, that's what's kicked it off in any event.
The Department of Justice report, the PATF report, and we also had two experts.
But that's not, there was opposing views with regard to what the Department of Justice said.
Certainly, but the jury heard the evidence. This is, right, to some extent, the city is arguing about the jury findings here. They're arguing, well, it's not really causation. They did not object to the lack of a conscience-shocking instruction, and we actually proposed a conscience-shocking instruction, for the record. So the city today is complaining, many of their complaints really go to the way the case was tried and the way the jury was instructed, although we have no doubt that regardless of the instructions, the evidence was overwhelming here. But the state action is, in fact, the policy. It's no different than if the city had a law that said police officers are authorized to shoot anybody they want when they are off duty or on. The fact that they might do it when they're off duty and therefore themselves might not have committed a constitutional violation does not relieve the city of its duty not to empower police officers to behave in violent and lawless ways. And again, police officers are somewhat unique. I talked about two different reasons. One is a factual one about the feedback loop. A second is the fact that they do carry the potential for color of law at 24 hours a day. But there's a third one, which is that they have the exclusive power themselves to investigate and to deter and to punish and to seek crime. They have and enforce the criminal laws. So if they are not obeying the criminal laws, if they are acting with impunity, it is different from any other state actor acting with impunity. It actually goes to the core of the rule of law. And if that's not conscience shocking, it's hard to say what would be. What we proved is a decades-long policy and practice that police officers are not accountable for their own actions, regardless of whether they break police department rules, regardless of whether they break criminal laws. Kelly is a case in point. When he beat up his girlfriend, in that case, the OPS department actually, investigator actually did sustain the allegation, but the head of the Office of Professional Standards herself reversed that finding with no explanation. She could not explain it at trial. She could not explain it in her deposition. She simply said, no, I don't think we should uphold this. When somebody is told repeatedly, as Kelly was, 19 times, that we are not going to punish you regardless of the laws you break, regardless of whether you hold a gun to somebody's head in front of their children, which he did on duty, was not punished for that. Regardless of whether you break your girlfriend's brother's nose, which he also did, regardless of whether you send her to the hospital with 7 stitches, because you are a police officer, because of that, we are not going to punish you.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Oh, excuse me. Thank you. We ask that you affirm the verdict in its entirety.
We we've just heard from counsel a number of arguments that have never been raised in this appeal before. They've never argued state action on Kelly's behalf. They've never argued that the policies are facially unconstitutional. They've never argued that police are uniquely positioned and therefore DeShaney doesn't apply for that reason. They didn't try the case on conscious shocking, nor did they argue that in their briefs. Nor do we complain about the instructions. On the contrary, we accept the instructions that were given and the findings that the jury made. The point in this case is that the jury was allowed to find against the city where there's no constitutional duty. That is DeShaney. When asked this morning how to identify the constitutional right, counsel stated that was a right to bodily integrity. That is not a freestanding or a right that the city violates, and therefore it's a constitutional violation. There has to be state action. The city has to owe a duty, and here the city did not owe a duty. Certainly in DeShaney and in Wilson Trattner, there were harms to bodily integrity, and in neither of those cases did the courts find that that was sufficient simply because city policies were involved. In fact, in Wilson Trattner, this court rejected a claim that failure to discipline or take steps to stop the officer from stalking his girlfriend and hurting her only emboldened him to continue doing it. These claims have been rejected across the country over and over. We heard a lot this morning about the facts of the case and the policies that were proved and causation. No amount of causation is going to create a duty. All the facts we accept, there were policies that the jury found. None of them is sufficient. There also has to be a duty.
Well, on that point, upholding this verdict really creates responsibility on the part of every police department in the circuit for the private misconduct of its officers when they're not on duty or acting under color of state law. Anything that any police officer would do off duty could potentially trigger liability on the part of the police department. So the police departments are responsible for all private actions of their officers.
That's true, Your Honor. And
as a constitutional matter, even negligent failure to supervise.
That's true. And since police are not unique, I don't think that would even be limited to the police department. Certainly all city employees don't become, you know, state actors all the time in every endeavor just because they also work for, you know, the government. And in fact, that's why the courts have rejected this theory. This court in Wilson Trattner and in Latuskin, and then the 2nd, 3rd, 9th, 6th, and 8th circuits as well in cases involving police officers. If there was any doubt, and we don't think police officers are distinguishable, but if there was any question about that, the courts have rejected that. And it's always claims just like this one. The city knew about drinking parties in the parking lot and allowed them to continue. And this led officers to believe they were above the law. That's Latuskin. Officials knew of complaints by the girlfriend in Wilson Trattner and allowed it to go ahead, emboldened the officer to continue his conduct. In Pitchell, the officer was out drinking with his friend and they went back to his apartment and then he shot his friend after an argument. That was not, even though there was a claim of inadequate training, screening, and supervision, that was not sufficient. And the cases go on and on and on. And again, no amount of knowledge on behalf of the government, no amount of what was happening is sufficient. In fact, in the Third Circuit case in Fate, the officer had 30 prior complaints of excessive force, including road rage incidents, and then the plaintiff was injured by this officer in a road rage incident. The cases are consistent. The outlier is Gibson. Council mentioned King. That is also not different. As we explain in our brief, that case also recognized that there needs to be a duty within the scope of DeShaney, otherwise there is no liability on behalf of the government. And finally, on the subject whether police officers are somehow uniquely situated, the case law has not ever set out a third option. There's state action, which has never been contested in this case. Plaintiff puts the state action only on the city, concedes that Kelly was acting privately. There's not a third option, and that's because only state action can violate the Constitution, not actions by a private actor, as plaintiff concedes Kelly was in this case. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, we ask that the judgment be reversed.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.